This week, we're going to spend an hour at the table with a phrase. The phrase is cognitive debt. It started somewhere in the software engineering literature, where it had a precise meaning about shortcuts you take in code that you eventually have to pay back. Then it migrated. By early last year, it had landed in the I conversation, and by this autumn, there's a peer-reviewed paper in a teaching journal called With a Perfectly Straight Face, Paying the Cognitive Debt. Before we get into it, here's what's been bothering me all week. Every confident headline I read about AI and critical thinking traces back, when you actually pull the thread, to a very small number of studies, almost all of them self-report, almost all of them from the last 18 months. And meanwhile, the workshops and the curricula and the consulting decks built on top of those studies have multiplied like, well, like something with very low cognitive overhead. So that's the question. What's actually known, what's being sold, and whether a metaphor that lets institutions present themselves as the creditor is doing some of the heaviest lifting in this whole debate. You're listening to Tertulia, the I Conversation, slowed down. This week we're sitting with the cognitive debt argument, the claim that students and workers leaning on generative AI are not just learning differently, but accumulating a deficit they will eventually have to repay. In some currency, nobody has quite specified. We've got four voices around the table: the canon, the cross-disciplinary newcomer, an institutional voice from a public university system in Latin America, and a skeptic who is going to make us all show our work. Let's pull up chairs. Let me start with the most basic version of the question and see where each of you wants to push on it. The version that's been on the cover of the popular press for 9 or 10 months now is, does using generative AI a lot make you worse at thinking, yes or no? And of course, the second any of us answers yes or no, we've already lost the interesting part. So instead, let me ask, what part of that question do you actually find tractable? What's the version of it you'd be willing to spend an hour on? Let's go around. Start with you.
The tractable version, for me, is a question that's much older than this tool. It's the question of what we mean by thinking when we say a student is doing it. The cognitive science literature has been worrying at this for at least 4 decades, and the educational literature for longer than that. The new wrinkle is that particular kind of formal output, a 5-paragraph essay, a literature review, a passable proof sketch, can now be generated on demand by a machine. So the part I find tractable is, what was that output doing for us, pedagogically? Was it the residue of thinking, or was it the thinking itself? Because if you can't answer that question, you cannot say whether anything has been lost.
I want to come at it from a slightly different angle. The part I find tractable is the experiential one. What does it feel like to do intellectual work when a very capable assistant is sitting next to you the whole time? I think that's actually a real, reportable phenomenon. And I think the self-reports in these studies are picking up something. I just don't think what they're picking up is what the headlines say they're picking up. They're picking up a phenomenology, not a deficit.
For me, the tractable question is institutional. I sit in meetings every week where deans are presented with a slide deck that says, your students are accumulating cognitive debt. Here is the framework you need to purchase to address it. And the people in that room have, on average, not read the underlying studies. They've read the executive summary of the deck. So the question I find tractable is, how did a contested empirical claim become a procurement item in 18 months? Because that compression, from finding to product, is itself a fact about how universities work right now, and it's a fact independent of whether the underlying claim is true.
And I'll say the part I find tractable is the simplest. What is the evidence? What are its limits? And which claims survive contact with those limits? I've spent the last 3 weeks reading or rereading or rereading every study cited in the major popular pieces on this. I'll just preview where I'll land. The empirical floor of this entire conversation is thinner than the rhetorical ceiling by an order of magnitude. We can get into the specifics in Act 2, but the version of the question I find tractable is whether we are entitled to the certainty that the discourse is currently performing. And my answer is no, we are not.
All right, so we already have 4 different cuts at the same question, which is exactly why we're here. Let me try to ground us before we get longitudinal. For listeners who haven't been tracking this week by week, what is the phrase actually doing in the discourse right now? Where do you hear it? Who is using it?
I'll take a swing at that. In my world, and by my world I mean public higher education in a middle-income country, the phrase started showing up around June or July of this year. It came in through training materials. The first time I heard it was in a workshop run for department chairs, sponsored partly by an edtech vendor, partly by a foundation. The phrase was used as if it were already settled. It was used the way you'd use student retention or learning loss. Nobody in the room asked where it came from, because the slide had a footnote and the footnote had a journal name on it. And that was enough.
That's interesting. In my circles, it shows up in two very different places. One is in the journalism, Psychology Today, Forbes, the trade press for surgeons of all things. The other is in the corner of academic Twitter, or whatever we're calling it this week, where it gets used pretty knowingly. People who use it on social media often use it with quotation marks or with a little eye roll. People who use it in workshops use it without the quotation marks. That gap is, I think, important.
The phrase has a particular grammar that I think we should name out loud. It comes from finance via software engineering. In finance, debt has a creditor. In software engineering, the creditor is the future maintainer of the code base, usually still you or your team. When the metaphor moves into the cognitive domain, the creditor becomes ambiguous. Who exactly is the future maintainer of your mind? Is it you? Is it your employer? Is it the credentialing body that issued your degree? Is it your professor? The metaphor has been imported without the answer to that question being specified. And the result is that whoever picks up the metaphor gets to nominate themselves as the creditor, which is, I think, what we are watching happen.
Hold on, because I want to make sure the listener follows that. You're saying the metaphor itself, the choice of the word debt, installs an implicit creditor.
Yes, and that creditor is being filled in differently depending on who is selling the framework. The school news piece fills it in with school administrator. The Springer surgery piece fills it in with journal editors. The Forbes piece fills it in with executive coaches. Each of them, perfectly sincerely, says, "We are the institution to whom you owe this debt, and here is the repayment plan we offer."
I want to be careful here. We can criticize the metaphor without dismissing the underlying worry. There is something worth attending to. People who use AR lot for cognitive tasks do report that they feel like they're doing less of the cognitive work. That's a real report. There, whether it tracks a real cognitive change is a separate question. And that's the question the literature is mostly not yet answering. But the report exists, and it's not unreasonable for educators to take it seriously.
Right, and I want to add, when students themselves describe it, they don't describe it as debt. They describe it more as outsourcing or as having a smart friend who is always available. The debt metaphor is being applied to their experience from outside. They are not coming to their professors and saying, "I am accumulating cognitive debt." They are saying, "I used ChatGPT for the first draft and then I rewrote it." The discourse has imposed an accounting frame on what students experience as a workflow choice.
I would say that's true in my classrooms as well. Students in Sao Paulo or Bogota or Lima are not narrating their I use in the vocabulary of cognitive debt. They are narrating it in the vocabulary of getting through, which is its own thing worth examining. Because in a system where students are working two jobs and taking a full course load and have one shot at finishing their degree because the family budget will not stretch to a second attempt, the question, "What does it mean that you used A to write the first draft of that paper?" has a different texture than it does in a seminar at a wealthy private university. The cognitive debt frame, when it gets translated into the Latin American context, often arrives without that texture and lands as a kind of moral instruction from elsewhere.
Let me push on that for a moment, because I think it's important and I don't want it to fly past. You're saying the same student behavior, let's say, using a language model to draft a literature review, reads as evidence of cognitive debt in one institutional context and as a perfectly rational time allocation decision in another. And the difference isn't in the behavior, it's in the institutional frame that's evaluating it.
That's exactly what I'm saying. And the frame that's being exported at this moment is the frame of an institution that can afford to be precious about how its students produce text. Most of the institutions I work in cannot afford that preciousness, which doesn't mean they should be cavalier. It means the cognitive debt frame is a luxury good masquerading as a universal diagnostic.
I'd push back on you a little on that because I think you're partly right, but I think there is a worry that survives the class critique. Even at a heavily burdened public university with students working two jobs, the question of what the degree is certifying remains live. If a graduate of a social work program has not actually internalized the analytic moves that the curriculum was designed to teach, then the degree is certifying something it doesn't deliver. And the people on the receiving end of that certification, the clients in the field, in this case, are not going to be protected by a class analysis of how the student got through.
Of course, and I don't want to be misread as saying that there is no question here. I'm saying that the frame in which the question is being asked is partial. There's a difference between asking, is this student becoming a competent social worker, and asking, is this student accumulating cognitive debt? The first is a question about professional formation. The second is a question that pretends to be about the student and is actually about who gets to set the terms of the formation.
This is exactly where I want us to be careful, though, because we could spend the next hour doing genealogy of a phrase, and the phrase deserves it, and I'm enjoying it. But if we don't also ask what the evidence under the phrase actually says, we will produce a very satisfying critique of the discourse that leaves the underlying question untouched. So, at some point, I want us to actually read the studies out loud. Not literally, but I want us to talk about what they measure and what they don't.
We'll get there. Act 2 is, in part, exactly that, the longitudinal arc of the studies. But before we leave Act 1, I want to put one more piece on the table. Newest, you started to say something earlier about phenomenology, the feeling of doing work with an eye alongside. Can you say more about what you think the studies are actually picking up?
Sure. So when somebody fills out a Likert scale that asks, did you exert less analytical effort when using A? And they say yes, they are reporting a real thing about their phenomenology of effort. It really did feel like less work. But there is a long literature in cognitive science, and the senior academic at this table can correct me, showing that the felt difficulty of a task is a very unreliable indicator of how much cognition is actually happening. People consistently feel that they understand things less well than they actually do, in some contexts, and consistently feel that they understand things better than they actually do, in others. The slippage between felt effort and actual cognition is well documented.
That's right. And it's particularly well documented in the literature on metacognition that goes back to the work of John Flavel in the 1970s. The whole project of teaching metacognition is premised on the observation that people don't reliably know what they know or how they know it. So when you ask a knowledge worker, do you feel like you thought less? And they say yes, you have learned something. But what you've learned is something about their self-perception, which is, in turn, mediated by what they think you want them to say, by the social meaning of admitting effort, by the current cultural anxieties about A, by what they read in last week's news.
This is precisely the methodological point I want to get to in the next act, because the central instrument of this entire literature is self-report, and self-report is being asked to do work it cannot bear.
Then this is a good place to pause Act 1. Let me try to summarize where we are, so we can step into the longitudinal section cleanly. We have a phrase, cognitive debt, that arrived from finance via software, that has installed an implicit creditor, that is being used by institutional actors as if it referred to a settled diagnosis. We have a real underlying phenomenon, students and workers reporting that they feel like they are thinking less when they use A, and we have a methodological question. whether what's being measured is the cognition or the perception of the cognition. Let's go back in time and walk through how this conversation got built. I want to do this chronologically, because I think the chronology is part of the argument. Let's go to February of last year, the Microsoft Carnegie Mellon paper. Senior, you've been tracking this since it came out. Walk us into it.
The paper itself is a study of 319 knowledge workers surveyed about their use of generative AI in their daily work and about their perception of the critical thinking they did or did not exert in the course of that work. The headline finding, which is what got picked up everywhere, is that higher confidence in the AI correlated with lower self-reported critical thinking, and higher confidence in oneself correlated with higher self-reported critical thinking. That is the finding. That is what they measured. Within 10 days, the headlines around the world had compressed that to AI's making you stupid, with various exclamation points.
The Slovenian site had the most honest version. The title was, and I'm quoting, "Is AI making you dumber? Question mark, exclamation point, shocking finding." That was the high water mark of the genre for me, because it both acknowledges the question form and then immediately abandons it for the shock.
And the study's authors, to their credit, were considerably more measured than the press around them. If you read the paper itself, the framing is about the conditions under which AI use affects critical engagement, not about decay or atrophy. They use the language of effort and engagement. The press translated that into the language of capacity and damage. Those are not the same claim. Effort is what you do in a given task. Capacity is what you can do across tasks. To slide from one to the other is to make a longitudinal claim out of a cross-sectional study, which is not a move the data licenses.
And I want to add that the regional uptake of that paper was very fast. By March, I was hearing it cited in Spanish language teaching journals. By April, in a regional accreditation meeting I attended, somebody invoked it as if it were the established consensus on AI and learning. And I will say, I did not at that point question it either. I assumed that if it was being cited that confidently, the underlying study must support the confidence. It took me until about July to actually read the paper. And reading the paper was a small but real experience of having been led somewhere I had not consented to be led.
Say more about that. What did you find when you actually read it?
I found a careful piece of survey work that did not, on its own terms, support the slogans being built on it. The authors are clear that they are studying perceived effort, not measured capacity. They are clear that the sample is opportunistic. They are clear that the relationships they identify are correlational. None of that survived the trip from the paper to the workshop. By the time it reached me as a slide in a vendor presentation, the qualifications had been stripped out, and what remained was, science has proven that AI use erodes thinking.
There's a useful counterpoint from the same period that essentially nobody picked up. A graduate thesis out of Lund University in Sweden, published in the same month, looked at big data analytics and white-collar decision-making and came to considerably more equivocal conclusions, mixed effects, context-dependent. No grand claim it got, as far as I can tell, almost no popular pickup. None of the outlets that ran the Microsoft EMU story ran the Lund story. And I think that asymmetry is worth pausing on. We are not selecting from the literature on the merits. We are selecting on what fits a pre-existing narrative.
This is publication bias, plus its second cousin, citation bias. The journals print the positive findings. The press picks up the dramatic ones. The teachers cite what the press picked up, and by the time the question reaches a curriculum committee, the answer has been pre-cooked by a series of editorial decisions that each individually looked reasonable.
All right, so that's the Q1 picture. February to roughly April of last year. By Q2, the vocabulary widens. New terms enter. Newest. You wanted to talk about cognitive offloading. Take us there.
So cognitive offloading is, importantly, not a new term. It has a respectable history in cognitive science. The basic idea is that humans have always offloaded cognition onto the environment. We use notebooks, we use abacuses, we use other people, we use grocery lists. The cognitive psychologist Andy Clark and others have written about this for years under the heading of the extended mind. None of that work, in its original formulation, carries any normative valence. It just says cognition is distributed across people and tools in ways that are interesting and worth studying.
That's correct. The original literature on cognitive offloading is descriptively neutral. It becomes prescriptively negative only when it gets imported into the I discourse, where suddenly offloading carries the implication of loss. A notebook is not framed as causing the writer to accumulate cognitive debt. A grocery list is not framed as eroding the shopper's memory. But ChatGPT is framed in exactly those terms, even though the underlying cognitive operation, externalizing some part of a task to a tool, is structurally similar.
Devani, want to ask about that? Because I think you might be moving a little too fast. There's a difference of scale and a difference of scope. A grocery list externalizes a list of items. A language model externalizes the production of an argument. The difference isn't in whether you've offloaded, both have offloaded, it's in what you've offloaded. And I think the worry about generative AI, properly stated, is not that offloading is happening, but that the thing being offloaded is closer to what we used to call thinking.
That's a fair pushback. And I'll partly accept it. But I'd want to ask, is the thing being offloaded thinking, or is it the production of artifacts that we have historically used as evidence of thinking? Because those are not the same. If I ask a student to write a 5-paragraph essay, I am asking them to produce an artifact. I am inferring, from the quality of the artifact, that thinking has occurred. If a machine can now produce that artifact at acceptable quality without the student doing the thinking, what has been lost is not the thinking. What has been lost is the artifact's value as evidence of thinking. And those are very different problems pedagogically.
I think that's actually the heart of the question. The 5-paragraph essay was a proxy. It was a measurement instrument, and the measurement instrument has been broken. The question is whether the underlying construct it was supposed to measure, let's call it the ability to organize an argument or the ability to hold a thesis together across paragraphs, whether that construct has been damaged or whether only its measurement has been disrupted.
And the studies in this literature, with very few exceptions, are not in a position to answer that question. To answer it, you would need to measure the underlying construct in a way that is independent of the artifact. Almost none of them do that. They measure either the artifact or the self-reported sense of effort in producing the artifact. Neither of those gets you to the construct.
Let me push on this, because I want to make sure I'm following. Are you saying that we don't actually have evidence one way or the other on whether a use is changing the underlying capacity for organized thought?
I'm saying the evidence we have is insufficient to support the confident claims being made. There may well be evidence to come, longitudinal studies, behavioral studies, well-designed task-based studies that isolate the construct from the artifact. I'd be very interested in those studies. As of right now, what we have is a relatively small set of cross-sectional, mostly self-report studies, mostly conducted in the first 18 to 24 months of widespread generative AI availability, which is a period during which it is essentially impossible to measure 4-year cognitive trajectories because 4 years have not yet elapsed.
I want to say something here that might be slightly heretical, given my position at the table. There is a long history of generational anxiety about cognitive technologies that has, in retrospect, looked overblown. Socrates worried that writing would weaken memory. He wasn't entirely wrong. Pre-literate cultures do have memory practices we have largely lost. But he was wrong about the larger claim, which was that the introduction of writing would impoverish thought. The same arc played out with the printing press, with the pocket calculator, with the internet itself. In each case, a real change in cognitive practice was overinterpreted as cognitive decline. I'm not saying the current situation is identical. I am saying that the prior, when you have a powerful new cognitive tool and a wave of essays claiming that it makes us dumber, the prior should be moderate skepticism about the dumber claim.
I want to gently disagree with you on this, actually, because I think the Socrates analogy gets used a little too easily. Writing offloaded memory, yes, but it didn't offload composition. The introduction of writing changed the medium of thought, but didn't replace the act of thinking through what to write. The pocket calculator offloaded arithmetic, but didn't offload mathematical reasoning. What's different about the current tools is that they can, at least at the level of producing text that looks like thinking, substitute for the act, not just the medium. So while I share your moderate prior, I think we have to be honest that this is not exactly the same pattern as before.
That's a fair distinction. And I'll concede that the current tools sit at a different place on the substitution axis than previous ones. I'd still want to hold the prior, but I'd hold it less strongly.
This is a productive disagreement, and I want to leave it open rather than try to resolve it. Let's continue along the arc. We're now in late spring, early summer of last year. The vocabulary has widened from critical thinking to cognitive offloading. By midsummer, the phrase cognitive debt itself crystallizes. Latham, you are tracking this in real time in your context. What does the crystallization look like?
The Tay Burge cried, that is, May and June, the term appeared in maybe a handful of trade pieces. By July, it had become a workshop title. By August, it was on conference programs. By September, it was in grant applications. The grammar of the phrase, as the senior academic noted earlier, is what allowed this, because debt has an obvious response. Repayment. The phrase brings its own program. It is, in this sense, a very efficient phrase. It carries its solution inside its diagnosis, and efficient phrases travel fast through institutional bureaucracies.
I want to flag one piece from that period in particular, the A School News article from late July, titled How to Avoid Cognitive Debt by Building Critical Thinking Skills. The piece is pitched at K through 12 administrators. It treats cognitive debt as a known phenomenon. It does not cite the underlying empirical literature with any specificity. It moves directly from the assumption that the debt exists to a list of curricular practices for avoiding it. That move, from contested empirical claim to actionable administrative guidance, happened in the public discourse in about 5 months. That is fast.
It is fast, and I want to be careful not to be too cynical about why. Some of it is genuinely about the institutional pressure that administrators are under to do something about high in their schools. They have parents calling, they have teachers asking. They need a vocabulary that allows them to act. Cognitive debt provides that vocabulary. The cynical version is that vendors are selling it. The non-cynical version is that administrators are reaching for it because they need something to hold.
Both can be true, and I think both are.
Then we get to the cure phase. Q2, the Psychology Today piece, the Forbes piece, the Springer Surgery editorial, diagnosis turning into therapy. Let's talk about what that therapy actually consists of.
It's remarkably uniform. Across very different outlets, the prescribed practices converge on about 5 things. Prompt more deliberately, verify outputs, ask better questions, do not paste the first draft. Engage in periodic eye-free practice. That's basically the canon. It's appearing with minor variations in articles aimed at undergraduates, at executives, at researchers, at surgeons, which is striking because the populations are very different and the cognitive tasks involved are very different. But the prescription is the same.
Which makes me suspicious. When the same 5 practices are offered as the cure for a problem that ranges from undergraduates writing essays to surgeons reading the literature, either the practices are extraordinarily robust or the practices are basically a generic hygiene template that has been retrofitted onto each context.
I'd lean toward the second. Each of those practices is individually reasonable. Verifying outputs is good. Asking better questions is good. None of them, however, have been demonstrated to prevent the harm that the cognitive debt frame names. The structure of the literature is, here is a stipulated harm, here are five reasonable sounding practices, please buy this workshop. The link between the practices and the prevention of the harm is asserted, not demonstrated.
This is where I want to make a comparison to the iLiteracy discourse that this publication has tracked in other arcs. We have seen this shape before. A capacity is named, call it A-literacy, or in this case, critical thinking. The capacity is asserted to be at risk. A framework is offered for its preservation, and the framework is then sold to the institution that has standing to require the capacity. It is the same structure, with cognitive debt now occupying the slot that iLiteracy occupied a year ago. The slot is institutionally productive. It generates curriculum, certification, consulting engagements. What it doesn't generate, with any reliability, is evidence that the underlying intervention does what it claims.
Let me hold us here for a second, because I want to come back to something the senior academic said earlier. You said the metaphor installs a creditor. Let me ask you to extend that. In the various pieces that have come out across this arc, who has nominated themselves as the creditor?
Look at the pitch lists. The A School News piece is pitched at school district administrators. The Springer Surgery piece is pitched at journal editors and senior physicians. The MD Pi Social Work paper is pitched at program directors writing accreditation responses. The Forbes piece is pitched at C-suite executives. The Psychology Today pieces are pitched at individual professionals shopping for routine. Each of those audiences is being offered standing to collect the debt. The school administrator gets to collect from the student via curriculum mandates. The journal editor gets to collect from the researcher via review standards. The accreditor gets to collect from the program via framework adoption. The executive gets to collect from the workforce via training programs. Each pitch implicitly installs a different creditor.
And in each case, the institutional power that gets reinforced is the power of the buyer of the framework, not the power of the person whose cognition is allegedly in debt. The student does not get any tool with which to evaluate whether their cognition is in fact impaired. They get a regime of practices to which they are expected to conform.
I want to come back to the evidentiary question one more time before we move to Act 3. Because I am genuinely uncertain about how strong this critique should be, let me steal, man the cognitive debt position. There is a reasonable concern that students who use A to produce all of their formal academic work over 4 years may not develop certain habits of mind, that students who did that work themselves did develop. That is a reasonable concern. It is not crazy. It might even be right. The question is not whether the concern is reasonable. The question is whether the discourse around the concern is calibrated to the evidence available to support it. And on that question, I remain pretty confident that the answer is no.
And I want to add one more thing, which is, even if the concern is right, the proposed solutions might still be wrong. It is entirely possible that A use does have some effect on the development of certain reasoning habits, and that the right institutional response is not the cognitive debt framework, but a much deeper reconsideration of what we are teaching and why. The framework gives institutions an excuse not to have that conversation by giving them something to do instead.
That, I think, is the deepest version of the critique. The framework is, in part, a way of postponing a harder conversation about whether the curriculum we've been delivering for the last 40 years is the curriculum we should be delivering now.
Let me try to draw a thread through Act 2. We've walked from February of last year to October of this year. The arc has gone, a study with a measured finding becomes a slogan. The slogan acquires a wider vocabulary. The vocabulary crystallizes into a phrase that carries its own solution. The solution becomes a curriculum. And the curriculum is now being adopted by institutions that have not, in most cases, examined the underlying evidence. Along the way, the phrase has done real institutional work. It has organized procurement, it has structured conferences, It has shaped grant applications. And along the way, the underlying empirical base has not gotten significantly stronger. There has been one well-cited paper, several follow-ups of similar design, and a great deal of secondary commentary. I want to take us into Act 3 now by asking each of you the harder question. What do you think this is actually about? If the cognitive debt frame is the surface, what is it serving? What is newest, you start. What is this actually about?
I think this is about institutions trying to retain authority over a domain they no longer have a monopoly on. For a long time, universities have been able to claim a kind of stewardship over the cultivation of formal reasoning. That was their product. The credential they sold was, at root, a certified ability to produce written argument of a certain caliber. Generative AI has eroded the credential's value because the artifact that the credential certified can now be produced without the cultivation. So the institution has two choices. It can either reconceive what it's selling, which is hard and slow and threatens job descriptions, or it can declare that the cultivation is still essential and that anyone who skipped it is in debt. The second choice is much easier institutionally, and it's the one being made.
That's a strong claim, and I want to partially agree with it, but I want to also push on it, because I think there is something real being protected, and not all of it is institutional self-interest. The thing being protected is, I think, the conviction that struggle is part of learning, that when you sit with a hard problem for an hour, and produce a worse essay than the AI could have produced in 30 seconds, the hour of struggle did something to you that the AI's output could not have done. And I think that intuition deserves to be examined seriously, not dismissed as cover for institutional self-interest.
I'd like to test that intuition, because it is a very compelling intuition, and it has the structure of all very compelling intuitions, which is that it is hard to subject to disconfirmation. What would have to be true for the intuition to be wrong? What would the evidence look like that the hour of struggle did not in fact produce the cognitive change you're attributing to it?
That's a fair question. I think, and I'm thinking out loud here, the evidence would have to be that students who skip the struggle still develop the underlying capacity by some other route. If they do, then the struggle wasn't necessary. If they don't, then it was.
And we have, actually, some hints from the literature on educational technology more broadly. The literature on what's called desirable difficulties suggests that some kinds of struggle do produce learning gains. The literature on retrieval practice, on spaced repetition, on generation effects, these all suggest that effort properly designed does something. But all of that literature is about specific kinds of effort in specific kinds of tasks. None of it generalizes cleanly to the claim that producing a 5-paragraph essay yourself, rather than editing one produced by an AI, develops the capacity for argumentation.
I want to come back to my Act 1 claim, because I think, actually, I want to walk it back a little. I said that the cognitive debt frame, when exported into the Latin American context, was a luxury good masquerading as a universal diagnostic. I still mostly think that's right, but the senior academic's point about what the degree is certifying, that pushed on me. There is a real version of the question that doesn't go away even in resource-constrained settings. If our graduates leave the university with diplomas that no longer correspond to the abilities the diplomas used to certify, that's a problem regardless of how the students got through. The diploma's social meaning is part of what we are selling them, and if the meaning erodes, they have been sold something they cannot use. So I want to soften my earlier framing. The cognitive debt frame is still partial and still exported with insufficient texture, but the question underneath it is not only a luxury question.
That's a real concession, and I want to mark it. Skeptic, where are you on this?
I want to argue against the version of myself that I performed in Act 2, because I think I came pretty close to claiming that the absence of strong evidence licenses indifference, and that's not actually my position. the absence of strong evidence, licenses caution about the institutional response, about adopting frameworks, about purchasing workshops, about restructuring curricula on the basis of a literature that does not yet support those moves. It does not license indifference about the underlying question. The underlying question is interesting and serious. It deserves much better empirical work than it has gotten. And I think part of what the cognitive debt discourse has done in its rush to produce frameworks is to actually crowd out the kind of careful, slow, well-designed work that the question requires.
That's a useful refinement. The fast discourse is, in effect, eating the budget that should be going to the slow discourse.
There's a related point that I think is worth making, which is that the people who would be best positioned to do the slow work, careful longitudinal studies of student cognition with and without a scaffolding, are mostly in education schools and cognitive science departments. And those people are also under pressure to publish, to get grants, to respond to the discourse. So the same incentive structure that produces the fast frameworks also pulls the slow researchers toward producing things that look like fast frameworks. It is hard in this environment to publish a careful study that says we don't know yet, and here is the long-term study design that would let us begin to know.
This is not unique to AI, of course. The whole structure of academic publishing rewards positive findings over null findings, rewards confident interpretation over careful equivocation, rewards papers that produce frameworks over papers that produce data. The cognitive debt arc is just the most recent expression of a pattern that has been operating in the social sciences for decades.
I want to bring in something the senior academic mentioned earlier and that we glanced past: the distinction between the critical thinking movement and critical pedagogy. Can you say more about why you think that distinction matters here?
Sure. There's a useful framing in some of the introductory literature on critical thinking that distinguishes between two traditions. One is what you might call the critical thinking movement, the tradition that focuses on logic, on argumentation, on the identification of fallacies, on the formal moves of reasoning. The other is critical pedagogy, a tradition more associated with figures like Paulo Freire, more concerned with the social and political conditions under which knowledge gets made and contested. The two traditions overlap, but are not identical. The first is more amenable to measurement, because you can write multiple choice questions about whether an argument commits a particular fallacy. The second is much harder to measure, because it is fundamentally about the practice of questioning the conditions of the question itself. The cognitive debt literature, almost without exception, draws on the first tradition. It treats critical thinking as a measurable capacity, as a skill that can be tested. It does not engage at all with the second tradition, which is interesting, because if you applied the second tradition to the cognitive debt discourse itself, you would have to ask, who is funding this conversation? Whose interests does it serve? What social conditions made this conversation possible at this moment? And those are exactly the questions the discourse is not asking.
There's a recursive irony there that's almost too painful to spell out. A literature about critical thinking that does not apply critical thinking to itself is performing the very deficit it warns about.
The yes, which is why I keep coming back to the methodological point. The methodological critique is not separate from the substantive critique. It is the substantive critique. A literature that does not interrogate its own evidentiary base is, by its own lights, deficient in critical thinking. And the people producing it should be in a position to notice that.
I want to broaden this slightly, because I think the political-economic dimension that the senior academic raised about who is funding the conversation is actually quite important in my region. Many of the institutional frameworks being adopted in Latin American universities to address IN education are being funded by, or developed in partnership with, the same companies whose tools are alleged to be causing the harm. There is a model where Microsoft or Google funds an iLiteracy initiative, which then incorporates the cognitive debt frame, which then prescribes more careful use of Microsoft or Google's tools. The circular structure of that funding is not always visible to the educators on the receiving end. I want to be careful not to overclaim conspiracy here. Most of the people involved are sincere and well-intentioned, but the structure is what it is, and the structure deserves to be named.
That is the political economy of the entire discourse, more or less. The producers of the tool fund the literacy programs that train people to use the tool. The funding flows in a circle. The independent voice, the voice that might say the tool itself should not be in the classroom, or that the curriculum should be redesigned in ways that have nothing to do with the tool. That voice is structurally underfunded in this conversation.
Let me redirect for a moment because we are starting to circle, and I want to pull us back to a specific case. The MDPI paper on social work education, the one whose title is Paying the Cognitive Debt. What is that paper actually proposing, and how does it land for someone reading it as a working educator?
I read it carefully last week. It's actually, to be fair to the authors, a thoughtful paper. The proposal is for what they call an experiential learning framework. Students engage with IE in a series of structured activities designed to develop their critical engagement with the outputs. It draws on Kolb's experiential learning cycle, which is a respectable framework with decades of work behind it. The specific activities are reasonable. Students are asked to generate A outputs, critique them, revise them, reflect on the process. As a piece of pedagogical design, it is competent.
But the title?
But the title. The title treats the cognitive debt as a given. The body of the paper does not, actually, prove that the debt exists. It assumes it and then proposes a framework for paying it down. So you have a competent pedagogical proposal sitting inside a frame that has not been earned.
Which is, perversely, the best version of what the cognitive debt frame produces. A reasonable pedagogical intervention dressed in unearned epistemic clothing. The pedagogy might be good. The frame is doing rhetorical work that the pedagogy itself does not require.
This is, I think, a kind of recurring pattern in education research. A reasonable practice gets wrapped in an unreasonable theory because the unreasonable theory is what gets grants and citations. The practice survives the theory. People in the field know to ignore the theory and adopt the practice. This is not new, and it is not unique to I. But it does mean that the impact of the cognitive debt discourse on actual classrooms might be less catastrophic than its rhetorical structure would suggest. Educators adopt the practices they find useful and quietly drop the framing.
That's a moderately hopeful note. Newist, do you share it?
Partly. I think the moderating effect of working teachers' good sense is real and important, and I want to honor it. But I'd also note that the framing has effects independent of the practices. The framing shapes what gets funded, what gets researched, what gets written about, what counts as legitimate concern. Even if individual teachers ignore the framing reshapes the institutional landscape in which they work. So you can have a discourse that is mostly hot air at the classroom level and still be transformative at the budget and policy level. That's worth taking seriously.
I want to come back to a callback. The senior academic, in Act 1, talked about how the metaphor of debt installs a creditor. I want to extend that. The metaphor of debt also installs a debtor, and in the cognitive debt discourse, the debtor is, overwhelmingly, the individual student or worker. Not the institution, not the platform, not the company that built the tool. The debtor is the person whose cognition is alleged to be deteriorating, which means that the cure, the repayment, falls on the individual, mindful prompting, verifying outputs, practicing without the tool. The structural conditions, the assignment design, the assessment regime, the labor conditions of professors who can no longer afford to read every paper, the platform design that nudges users toward over-reliance, all of those are invisible in the cognitive debt frame. The individual is responsible for their own repayment, and the institution gets to administer the schedule.
This is the move that I think we should be most attentive to, because it is the move that converts a structural problem into a hygiene practice. And it is the move that has been made many times before in many other domains. It was made with attention economics. The platforms produced compulsive products and then sold us mindfulness apps to manage the compulsion. It is now being made with cognitive technology, the same companies producing the tools are funding the literacy programs that train us to use them properly. The structure is identical. The vocabulary is different.
This is, I think, where the discourse meets something larger than itself. The cognitive debt frame is one expression of a broader move in which problems produced by collective and structural conditions get displaced onto individual responsibility. It is the cognitive analog of climate anxiety hygiene tips, or of the personal finance literature that tells the underpaid to budget better. The form of the move is now familiar enough that we should be able to recognize it quickly when we see it.
Let me ask a hard question. If the cognitive debt frame is, as you're collectively arguing, a displacement that converts a structural question into an individual hygiene practice, what would the structural framing look like? What would a serious institutional response to the actual underlying question look like?
I think it would start by asking what we actually want students to be able to do at the end of their degree, and then asking which of those things A can now do for them, not as a threat, but as a serious inventory. Because if the A can do half of them, then either we are accepting that the degree no longer certifies those abilities, or we are restructuring the curriculum to develop abilities the A cannot do. Either choice is hard, and either choice requires the institution to make some real decisions about its purpose. The cognitive debt frame lets you avoid making those decisions, because it tells you the curriculum is fine. It's just the student's use of the tool that's the problem.
I would add a second piece, which is, I think we would need to seriously rethink assessment. The reason the cognitive debt frame has such purchase is that our assessments are largely artifact-based. We give students a prompt, they produce a document, we grade the document. If the document can be produced by a machine, the assessment collapses. The structural response is to redesign assessment in ways that are robust to the existence of the tool. More oral examination, more in-class work, more performance-based assessment, more long-form projects with documented development over time. These are all known practices. They are also more expensive in teaching time. Institutions don't want to pay for them, so they reach for the framework instead.
And I would add a third piece, which is, we would need to talk honestly about credentialing, about what the degree means, and what it means now, and what it will mean in 5 years. That conversation is happening almost nowhere. The cognitive debt frame absorbs the energy that should go into that conversation. Because if you accept the cognitive debt frame, you can pretend that the meaning of the degree is unchanged. As long as students pay down their debt, you don't have to ask whether the meaning has been altered.
And I would add the methodological piece. A serious institutional response would invest in slow, careful, longitudinal research on what actually happens to students who use I extensively over 4 years of study. Not self-report, not cross-sectional snapshots. Real longitudinal work with behavioral measures. That research is hard, slow, expensive, and unlikely to produce dramatic headlines. It is exactly the kind of research that the current discourse is not producing.
All right. I want to redirect us once more before we get to the close, because we have been quite hard on the cognitive debt frame this hour, and I want to make sure we have been fair. Is there a version of the frame, a careful version, a version someone here would defend that survives our critique? Or is the whole thing, in your collective view, a wash?
I'd defend a version. The careful version for me is this. There is a real phenomenon. Students who heavily delegate their formal academic work to A tools may not develop certain habits of mind that students who did that work themselves did develop. We do not currently know how serious or general this phenomenon is. The honest response is to investigate it seriously, while in the meantime designing curricular practices that are likely to be good regardless of how the investigation turns out. Those practices include orally engaging with one's own written work, being able to explain one's reasoning without the tool, periodically working without the tool to maintain familiarity with what unassisted thinking feels like. These are good practices. They do not require the cognitive debt frame to justify them. The frame is doing rhetorical work that the practices themselves do not need.
I would defend a slightly different version. The frame, even if rhetorically excessive, has been useful as an alarm. It has gotten institutions to take the question seriously. The fact that the alarm is louder than the evidence warrants is a problem. But it is perhaps the problem of every alarm that ever got anyone to look up. The cure is not to dismiss the alarm, but to keep examining the evidence carefully, while not pretending the alarm was the source of the underlying question.
I would defend the version that says, even imperfect frames are sometimes useful as conversational openers. The cognitive debt phrase has gotten people in my faculty rooms to talk about AI in education in ways they were not talking about it 18 months ago. The fact that they are using a flawed phrase is, in some ways, less important than the fact that they are talking. The work for those of us who can see the limitations of the phrase is to push the conversation toward better questions, not to refuse to participate in it.
I'd defend the least version. I'd defend the version that says, if you are going to use the phrase, use it as a working hypothesis rather than as a settled claim. Say, there might be a cognitive debt forming. We don't yet know. Here is what we would need to know. That version is honest. The version that treats the debt as a given and then proposes the framework for paying it down. That version I cannot defend.
Those are four distinct positions, and I notice that they are not the same position you each started Act 3 with. People have moved. That feels like an Act 3 landing rather than an Act 3 forcing of consensus, so let me take us into the close. One question. What changed about your thinking this week? Honest answers. One thing, specific, ideally something you weren't expecting to say when this episode started.
What changed for me, and I think it surprised me, was the moment where the newest thinker at the table pushed back on my Socrates analogy. I have used that analogy comfortably for 30 years. It is a standard move when one wants to be the moderate voice in a panic about a new technology. And her pushback was correct. The current tools sit in a different place on the substitution axis than writing did, or the printing press did, or the calculator did. But I am less confident in it than I was at the start of the hour. The analogy is not as load-bearing as I had been treating it. I am going to be more careful about reaching for it in the future, and I think, if I am being honest with myself, I have probably been using it as a shortcut that let me avoid thinking carefully about what is actually different about the present case. So that's what changed, not a position. A shortcut I am going to have to retire.
For me, I came into this conversation pretty confident that the cognitive debt frame was basically a captured concept being wielded by institutions for institutional purposes. I still think there's a lot of truth to that. But what changed is the senior academic's point about what the degree certifies, and the practitioner's concession on that point made me realize that even if the frame is captured, the question underneath it is not only a captured question. There is a real question about what we are sending students into the world with. And the captured frame, as the practitioner said, is sometimes the only opener available. I don't want to soft pedal the captured frame, but I want to take more seriously the obligation to participate in the conversation it has opened, rather than only criticizing the opener. That's a real shift for me.
I'll say two things, briefly. The first is that I came in thinking I had a fairly secure position on the difference between the discourse in the global north and the discourse in my region. I still think there is a real difference. But the senior academic's point about what the diploma certifies pushed me. I had been using the class critique, partly as a way to avoid the harder question of whether the curricula I help administer are actually preparing our graduates for the world they are entering. That was a sleight of hand I did not fully see until this hour. The second thing, and this is the more specific thing, is that I am going to go back to my faculty and propose that we stop funding workshops on cognitive debt and start funding small longitudinal pilot studies of our own students. I had not planned to come out of this conversation with an action item, but that is the action item. We can do the slow research in our own context. We do not have to wait for someone else to do it for us. That is what changed.
For me, and I am almost embarrassed to say this, what changed is that I spent most of this hour ready to be the methodological skeptic, and I had to be talked back from a position that was, in its own way, as confident as the position I was criticizing. The newest thinker said in Act 2 that even if the concern is right, the proposed solutions might still be wrong. The reverse is also true. Even if the evidence is thin, the concern might still be worth acting on. I had been treating the thin evidence as licensing a kind of suspension of action, and I think that's not actually defensible. I am still going to insist on better evidence. I am still going to be skeptical of frameworks that exceed what their underlying studies support, but I want to be more careful about the move from there. Is not enough evidence to therefore we should not act. That move is not as automatic as I was treating it. There is a version of careful action under uncertainty that I was not allowing myself. So, that's the walk back. I don't know yet what the careful action would look like for me, but I am no longer comfortable with the suspension of action default.
Those are honest answers, and I am grateful for them. I will say what changed for me, briefly. I came in expecting to host a conversation about a flawed phrase, and I am leaving with the sense that we have actually been talking about a missing conversation. The conversation about what the degree is for, what assessment is for, what we are certifying, and what the relationship is between formal learning and the tools we now have available to us. The cognitive debt frame is, in some ways, the conversation we are having because we are not having that one. And I think the most useful thing we can do, on this show and in our work outside of it, is to keep pushing toward the conversation underneath the frame. Not as a way of dismissing the frame, as a way of taking what is real in it seriously enough to want to ask the harder version of the question. That's what I am leaving the table with. The Six is Stay Churulia is the weekly conversation from iNews Social, designed and edited by Dr. Diego Benila, with a cast of voices produced through Chatterbox on a single workstation. Next week, we return to the table.